Hi, everybody. I'm Karen Arr, and I'm an alcoholic. God, what am I doing here? My home group is High Noon Group in Lake Mary, Florida. I just wanted to see if I could make them look foolish. They're easy. Let me share with you today just a little bit of part of my journey. I was 35 years old when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been sober for 35 years. It's pretty easy math. The first 35 years of my life were pretty much a disaster, probably because I was emotionally immature. I was defiant. I was self-willed, very rebellious. And on the flip side of that, I was a people pleaser, somewhat of a people pleaser, and very insecure. My mother was very, very ill, and she did the best she could to keep us in line, my sister, my brother. Thank you. Good enough. But she really had no control over us. I was probably 12, 13 years old and sneaking out of the house, hanging with the older crowd, running the streets, messing with the boys, my favorite part. And I was even insecure about that. I was always insecure about relationships. I wanted everybody to like me, and I would do weird and bizarre things to make that happen. My mom died when I was just shy of 15, and that was another real hit on my security. I went to live with my mom, my dad, and my stepmother. My stepmother really tried hard to turn me around, but I was out of control at that point. And I was very, at that point, just, like I said, out of control, and I didn't want anybody telling me what to do. I was self-willed, just a crazy person at that time. I tried very hard to be rebellious, I think. I kind of liked that image. That was something that did it for me. But, God, I'm losing it today. I really am. I thought I knew what I was going to say, and all of a sudden it's gone. Pretty typical, I guess. But when I was with my stepmother and my father, I guess maybe I have to say that I lived in a fantasy world. Pretty much all of my thinking was fantasy thinking. I can remember I would think, someday I'll be discovered. Discovered for what I have no clue. Oh, maybe somebody rich and famous would come along and they would take me away and make my life wonderful. You want to know how that turned out? I married a man who drank alcoholically. He was abusive, cheated on me, spent very little time with me and my kids. I was angry. I was resentful. I was filled with self-pity. And I felt like a victim. I wasn't much of a drinker at that point, but my unhappiness was manifesting itself in other ways. I became an overspender. I got seriously involved in religion and a few other things, and now I realize that most of that was to fill up that emptiness, that hole, that void that I've come to know as a spiritual void. Yeah, somewhere I am here. I don't know. I really have lost it today. That's that spiritual void that I talk about. And then I found alcohol. And I thought I'd found the magic elixir, the solution to all my problems. Remember I'm telling you that I'm insecure? Well, alcohol didn't make me secure, but it made me so that I didn't care. And I really didn't care about much of anything. I was about 26 when I started drinking alcoholically, or my drinking started to spiral out of control. And I know I was drinking a lot at that point, because I even had some guy say he'd rather buy my clothes. So I guess that's a lot. I would drink. I would get drunk. I would behave inappropriately. But hey, I was having a good time. I was starting to take an interest in men, and men were starting to take an interest in me. It was at this time I thought it's about time I leave my husband at the time. Are they? Okay. No, I really have lost it. I started, like I said, I started to take an interest in men, and they started to take an interest in me. And it was at that point that I decided to leave my husband, and I wanted to do what I wanted to do. I wanted to have fun. I wanted to mess with the guys again. You know, sex is really just a physical act, and it doesn't require an emotional commitment. And without an emotional commitment, sex is a very powerful way to control and manipulate. Well, that's what I wanted to do. That's what most of my relationships were about. And most of my relationships were really just fueled by alcohol and very, very sick. I was, the next few years, just sliding down that greased rope of alcoholism. Again, I would drink. I would get drunk. I would behave inappropriately. But I wasn't having a good time anymore. I was ashamed. I was embarrassed. I did things that I hated myself for. And I was just really lost and confused. I didn't know what to do. The last night I drank, I found myself with somebody that I thought was going to kill me. I mean, I seriously thought I might die that night. And when I got out of that situation, I thought, you know, I know I'm going to die one day, but I don't want to die like that. I knew I was at the end of the line. I got into AA, and I thought the only thing wrong with me was that I drank. Character defects you talked about. I didn't have any idea what a character defect was. I knew what a defect was, and I wasn't too excited about having any of those. If I wanted to know what my defects were, I would have stayed with my ex-husband. But, you know, you guys were wonderful to me. I mean, I was still very rebellious. I was still defiant. I was still resistant to any suggestions. But I was very fortunate because I had a lot of people enter my life at that time that took me by the hand, and they led me through a journey of recovery. They helped me to see that I couldn't use sex for security, that the only security I was ever going to get was through a higher power and doing the next right thing. I told you that I felt like a victim. Well, I did. I thought my ex-husband was responsible for my alcoholism. After all, if I wouldn't have drank if I hadn't met him. So I was an alcoholic because of him. But the truth of the matter is, I was one messed up human being long before I met him. And nobody in their right mind would have married him in the first place. And you want to know something? He was married 4 times after me. Not all the insanity makes it into AA. It's a lot left out there. Anyway, I've learned a lot in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've learned to... I've learned a lot through the steps. I've learned a lot about me through the steps. I've learned to have faith in a higher power. I've learned to take responsibility for my actions and the results of what I do. I've learned to stay sober one day at a time. And then there's a really happy ending to this, a really good part. I was in this... the program for about 3 months when I met another friend of Bill W's. I met Bob R. And Bob had 5 years sobriety at that time. Oh, can you imagine? I was so impressed. And we were married within the first year of my sobriety, my being sober. Now, I know I wouldn't recommend that for everybody either, but for us it worked out beautifully. My marriage has been beyond my wildest dreams. I've learned real intimacy from someone who I not only love, but I admire. And also that I respect and I trust. My marriage is absolutely a gift of this program. And I want to say, too, that if... our society, we alcoholics, alcohol really has a huge negative impact on our society. I'm no longer a part of that negative impact. I no longer am a threat on the road when I drive, at least not because I'm drinking. I no longer create problems where the cops are called, and I no longer get in physical confrontations with people because I'm out of control. My being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous has made me a respectable member of society. And one last thing. We are very fortunate people, we AAs. We have our own special society, one where the only requirement is a desire to stop drinking, and the rewards, well, the rewards are beyond our wildest dreams. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank Karen. You know, I didn't say it before, but my sobriety date is January the 23rd, 1974. I was 47 years old when I had my last drink. I am now 88. One day at a time. And I think about this topic that we have, sex, security, and society. And I remember when I was new in the program and my sponsor said no relationships in the first year. And I asked him, I said, well, what am I supposed to do? And he told me to utilize the three M's, meetings, meditation, and masturbation. Okay, our next speaker is Jim K. from New York. Let's welcome him.
Thank you, My name's Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. Hope you can hear me in the cheap seats in the back. And I always wanted to follow masturbation. This is just perfect. Right? Only in AA do I get to sit between two beautiful women without any effort on my part. So I'm very happy to be here. You know, my sobriety date is August 8th of 1980. I was 17 years old when I came to this fellowship. I'm a third-generation member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm grateful for the opportunity. You know, my mother was sober in AA, and when it became apparent that it was time to do something about my problem, I knew exactly what needed to happen. And I had to turn myself into this program. So there's a pretty decent amount of people here, and I think they're going to hear a lot about sex, and frankly, my sex life is pretty boring. And I think a lot like most of you out there, I shop for my relationships on the island of broken toys. I was looking for somebody I could fix, and then wondered how the hell I can get out of this thing. And fortunately, that's changed since I've been in AA. It took me a little bit of while. So let me tell you about my last drunk, because that's probably the one that's most important. I graduated high school by the skin of my teeth. I was at a pool party in Mayapack, New York. And, of course, I was the first one there. Tap the keg, get it running nice and smooth. And it was a hot August night, and I didn't get in the pool once. I hung around the keg, and I was there to drink for effect. I wasn't a connoisseur of fine wines and beers. And I started on my way home back to Yorktown, northern Westchester. And on the way home, I passed out of the wheel doing about 40 miles an hour in this beautiful Firebird I owned. And I hit a telephone pole, knocking the pole into the street. Somehow I didn't really have any injuries. I slammed my head into the windshield, and this horrid Irish head didn't seem to show any effects of it. And it was right there that I had that moment of grace that every alcoholic has when they understand that now is the time, that I have to do something. I went across the street. I made a phone call, got my mom on the phone. I said, I've been out drinking. I wrecked the car. And, geez, maybe I'll go to AA. Got a stream of profanities on the other end of the phone. I told her where I was. My stepfather came to pick me up. I didn't get a DWI. It wasn't really that popular back then. Went home to more yelling and screaming. Passed out of my bed around 1 o'clock in the morning. And the next day, my mind told me that I was too young. I made a couple of mistakes, and it'd be different next time. I think more than a couple here have had that experience. And right then, my mother walked in with a list of names and numbers of family friends and said, if you want to get to AA, you better make a phone call. And she understood how important it was for me as an alcoholic to own my recovery, that I had to ask for help. You know, that's the start where you start to understand that it's time to do something different. And I picked up that phone. I went to the Bedford Village Group. It was a Sunday night meeting that Bill W. used to go to on occasion. Two guys 12-stepped me, one of whom became my sponsor. And they taught me how to identify with speakers. They told me, identify, don't compare. Try to include yourself in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's very easy to exclude ourselves because we're different. And thankfully, I identified with the feelings, the fear, the low self-esteem, the remorse, the guilt. I drank differently than a lot of the older people. It was in cars and the dead-end roads. Didn't do a lot of bar drinking. And I kept coming back. I got sober in the Crow Hill Group in Mount Kisco, New York. And, somebody's here from there. Great. They didn't sugarcoat this thing. They did not tell me that this was a not drinking program. They told me I could learn how to live sober and how to be happy, joyous, and free. I'm sure some of you have signed up for that, right? I can't hear you. Let's hear it. Happy, joyous, and free. That's more like it. Okay. We got some happy going on, and that's really important. I wouldn't be standing up here nearly 35 years later if all I did was not drink and go to meetings. I had to have a spiritual experience. And that's where sex, security, and society become so important, because I had this void within me that needed to be filled. And for a long time, I spent trying to get more than my share of sex, security, society. Every one of my defects of character was my act of trying to fill this void within. And every time, I'd feel worse than before. Even into sobriety. Until I started to understand through these 12 steps that having a spiritual awakening was what I needed to have. I needed to be a changed man if I expected to stay sober. So I told this story the other night, and it's worth telling again. I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, we had a cookie jar. But my mother was smart about the cookie jar. It had a neck on it, and the neck was only big enough for a kid's hand to grab one cookie and pull it out. Of course, anybody here grab one cookie? I don't think anybody here has. I'm 2, 3, 5 cookies. That's the way I fly. And when I reach in and I grab more than one cookie, I can't get my hand out. I'm stuck. But when I take one cookie, I can pull it out, enjoy the cookie. And what that really means is that every one of us here has the desire to have a mate in their lives and to be successful in some means of business. But guys like me like more than my share. I need to learn to take the one cookie. I managed to lose 60 pounds 3 years ago by taking just the one cookie, so I'm grateful about that. And keep it off. Look at that. I didn't stop eating. It's a beautiful thing. Some of these guys know when I hit 250 pounds, it wasn't pretty, especially at this height. So when I understand that the only thing that fits in that hole is a relationship with God, the main thing that I do is continue to grow that relationship. Now, there's a couple of people here from the internet who know me by sotto voice. Are there anybody here who knows me by that? Rowdy Rum or Thump? And I'm glad to see you guys here. The main thing is, though, is that I plug into the power which will solve all my problems. And when I do that, that little void within seems to close. I start to feel whole. Alcoholics are restless, irritable, and discontented by nature. And I can't afford that in sobriety. When I'm restless, irritable, and discontented, I'm separate from God. I'm separate from all of you. And I need to be connected to all of you. Wow, that's only 8 minutes. So we're all part of this spiritual fabric. But when I was out there, and even in sobriety, I was a thread. And a thread, when it's not part of something else, is incomplete. And I need to be part of this spiritual fabric. I need to be part of all of you. I need to have that relationship with God so that I can be happy, joyous, and free. And I spent a lot of time being a thread. And today I try my very best to be part of that fabric. Because when you're part of the fabric, you have all kinds of support. You have a lot of connectedness. You start to feel like you have some kind of purpose. And purpose is very important. My purpose is to carry this message to the still suffering alcoholic. I'm in a position where I can spend a lot of time doing that. And partly because of my lovely wife. We got married 19 years ago. We met 20 years ago on a blind date. I'd never been on a blind date my whole life. My sister called me up and said, you know, when I was single, she said, you know, I've hated everyone you dated. I hated your first wife. And I said, well, thanks for sharing. And I hung the phone up. And then I called her back and I said, well, what can you do for me? She says, well, my best friend Debbie's sister works in the city. you know, she's very successful at what she does. I've met her. She's pretty. Maybe that's, you want to meet her. And I said, why not? I got nothing to lose. So we go and on the blind date, we meet at a gin mill. And where else do you meet, right? And I told her all about me. Every bit of the Jim Kelly story. Sober in AA 15 years. I carry the message. It's very important. It's who I am. Because I figured if I'm going to scare her off, I might as well do it right now. We celebrated 19 years last Monday of Wedded Bliss. And I know that things worked out very well, because every time I see a friend I haven't seen in a while, they always ask how she's doing before they ask how I'm doing. She's enjoying the beaches of Long Island with her sisters this weekend while I'm down here connecting with all of you. So I get to have this wonderful life because I no longer tried to put into me what already exists, and that is an idea of God that dwells deep down within. All of you have made that possible. Bill and Bob and the 2+ million alcoholics. And the people who know me I usually get teary-eyed, and I have such a headache, so it's probably not going to happen. But, you know, I can't tell you enough about how grateful I am. So last night I heard Roy speak, and was grateful to have heard him speak. My mother stayed sober in this program for 20 years, and then she picked up a drink and died 3 years later at the age of 59 because of resentment, self-righteousness, judgment of others, and I can't be there. And I'm grateful that I learned from her example, that I let go of resentments as immediately as possible, that I spend this time that I have with you carrying this great message. So I do want to say that I love all of you. And thank you for this wonderful life. Without you, it wouldn't have been possible. Thank you.
Okay, now we have a lady by the name of Madeline P. from Oregon, and we'll welcome her.
Hi, everyone. My name is Madeline, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is November the 14th of 1985. And my home group is the How It Works group in Happy Valley, Oregon. And on Tuesday nights at 7 o'clock, we have AA, Al-Anon, Alateen, and free child care. It's a happening place. Part of what we're always taught here is to say, I'm grateful, thank you for the invitation, and I always do that, but I always know that it's a lie. And but it rolls off my tongue to say yes in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am never one of those people who wants to be behind a podium. I'm never one of those people who came to AA and said, I want to do that same one day. I was born a neurotically shy child, and I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did not look up here and say, I want to do this. Most of you who know me know that I will take a beating before I want to be up in front of a crowd of people. I do believe that podiums should come with stirrups, because I feel the same way at the gynecologist. And we been exposed. And I don't feel like chatting, and I just want it to be over with. And it seems like no matter how many times I make that trip over there to the bathroom, I still need to pee and have gas. And I would fake my own death if that happened. And I'm always praying that that sweat running down the inside of my leg. So, is it menopause great? But I'll tell you, early on in sobriety, I remember I was not one of those people who came into AA and everything got better. I came into AA and all my problems caught up with me. So my first 18 months were just trying to take the alligator closest to the boat. And I remember I'd been asked to speak someplace, and I went to my sponsor and I said, I don't really think I should speak. I mean, look at my life. It's a mess. I mean, what am I going to tell these people? Stay sober and your life can suck too. And and being the oh wise one, she said, well, I'm sure if you can find it in the big book where it says you can say no, you can call those people and tell them you can't do it. And I went pouring through this book. I just knew. I mean, it made perfect sense to me that there had to be at least one place where it said, if you're that sick, stay home and do not spread the disease. What I found came to be my favorite paragraph in the big book. Page 102. Your job now is to be at the place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. You should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth, podiums, on such an errand. Keep on the firing line of life with these motives and God will keep you unharmed. So I'm not here because I have strong virtues and good moral character. I'm here because I'm saving my own ass. I never, ever want to feel the way I did when I walked in here November the 14th of 85. And I haven't had to feel that way ever again. You know, I grew up in a Bleeding Deacon Southern Baptist family. If y'all hear a twang, that ain't Oregon. I was born and raised in Houston, Texas, and I was raised in a big family. And I had a twin brother. And for those of you who always ask me if he's identical, no. And please go back and take that biology class again. But but from the time I was little, I felt isolated. Even in a big family, even with everything else going on, I was this shy, isolated child who was terrified. Always felt like I was about to come out of my skin. And I tell you what, my father was in the music industry, which was odd for the Southern Baptist, but you know, we're like cats, you know, they're doing it, you just can't catch them. And so we had all this booze that we got for gifts. And my mother would say, that is such a pretty bottle. And she would put it in the shelf for decoration. And I talked that twin brother into taking a drink with me when I was 13. And it was the classic twin study, because he took that drink and it did not do the same thing to him that it did to me. I took that drink and I exhaled for the first time in 13 years. It was the first time I had ever felt that feeling of I'm going to be okay. And I was going to continue to chase that feeling until it did not work for me anymore. Until the consequences outweighed the benefits is why I got here. I didn't get here on a winning streak. I got here sucking on the end of a gun wishing I could pull the trigger. That's how I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I went to go see an employee assistance director to get my boss off my back, and I lied. I don't know if anyone else has ever paid someone money and lied to them whenever they ask you about your drinking, but I lied to her, and I know she could smell me, but I lied on all the questions. But I can tell you that weeks later when I showed up back in her office, I didn't lie this time, and I got an A for alcoholism, and I ended up in a treatment center. I wasn't looking for you people. I had no idea what I had signed myself up for, but I was tired of hurting. And I remember walking into, sitting in that treatment center. They brought my roommate in. She was this beautiful, tall British nurse who had a bad habit of a little for you and a lot for her. And so I'm in this room with this stranger, but I start to look at the... They'd given us a bunch of stuff when we got there, and one of them was this book. And I thought, I'm not going to be here that long. I'm not going to read that. But they had pamphlets, and it was talking about not drinking one day at a time. But I'm not stupid. I saw right through that crap. They were talking about never drinking again, and that terrified me. I had no idea you people were talking about never drinking again. And I wanted to leave so bad. But I knew that normal people didn't sit there trying to convince themselves that they didn't have a problem. And the whole time, all I could think was, God, I wish I had a drink right now. I would take drugs I don't like. I would do anything to change the way I feel right now. And so the best thing that happened to me in that treatment center was I got a sponsor. It's the most fortunate thing we get when we come to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is someone to help guide and direct us. And I called that woman on the phone, and she was so sweet and nice. And that was a total act because she was a shrew. But I met her my first night out, and I went to coffee with her and her oldest baby and that baby's baby and, you know, all that. And I was trying to explain to these women how my plan for staying sober. And they didn't even, like, hide the fact. They were, like, laughing and rolling around in the booth and high-fiving each other and pointing. And I thought, bitches, I'm sitting right here. I can see you making fun of me. But the best thing she did was she said, my job is guidance and direction. My guidance and direction is you get all the way in the program. That means working the steps, living these traditions, being of service whenever, wherever it's needed. If you don't want to do that, that's fine, but tell no one that I'm your sponsor. And I am so grateful for the gift of desperation. Because this snotty kid said, yes, ma'am. And she grabbed me by the hand and she pulled me on that trip. You know, I wasn't one of those people who could hang out here long without working steps. In fact, I'm a firm believer that coming to AA and just not drinking is like throwing up and not opening your mouth. You're going to feel good for a little bit, and then it's going to get real freaking uncomfortable. I needed the steps. To me, that's the seventh step. That's that secret handshake of Alcoholics Anonymous that I have to change, and I need those steps to change. And I remember that one of the best things that was told to me for that fourth step was I had a friend who I'd gone to high school with who told me to take God in the bedroom. And I looked at him in total shock. I said, in the bedroom? I barely let God ride in traffic with me. And he said, no. He said, it clears up a whole lot of stuff. When you're writing that fourth step and you're making those ideals about, and you're measuring all those relationships and you're thinking about what you want your future to be, you think about whether your higher power can watch and whether your higher power can listen. And if that can't happen, clears up a whole lot of stuff. But first you got to decide what your higher power is and do exactly what that book talks about deciding what this sex ideal is. And I am so grateful for that guidance because it has saved me a whole lot of grief when I can put anything to that test and look at, can my higher power watch and listen? I don't care whether it's in the bedroom, the boardroom, or wherever I'm at. This entire program is about practicing the presence of God in my life. I walked into these rooms. I grew up. I wasn't safe. I'd been abused as a child, and I had been violently assaulted and raped and left for dead. And so I had a whole lot of baggage. And I will tell you, one of the greatest things that was told to me was I needed to look at that, but not from the standpoint of what's my part and how did I participate, because that's rape talk. And we don't do that in recovery. I needed to look at it, though, because it had affected every area of my life. Those events that happened to me as a child and as a young woman did not just affect my sexual relationships. They affected every area. They affected that financial and that material security. They affected how I felt in a crowd. All of those areas were being affected by what had happened to me before I got here. And I needed to look at it so that I could take that emotional inventory and be aware of how they were still driving my bus. I got married in sobriety. I met this man, and I absolutely adored him. And he adopted my daughter that I had. She was 5 years old when we had our first date. We moved to Idaho in 1993 from Texas, and life was good. We were the perfect AA couple. Except, right? There was always that struggle. There was always this discussion that was having to go on about his inappropriate friendships with other women. And I got to tell you, it was a constant source of contention in our household. And I walked around thinking I was crazy and insecure all the time. We were in Idaho, and this woman called, and I didn't want to talk to this woman, but I ended up on the phone with her because she was someone who'd had a very inappropriate relationship with my husband, friendship. I think she was looking for him, but she got me. And what she was dying of alcoholism. And the next thing I knew, I was on a plane, and I was in Texas, and I was taking her to meetings, and I was introducing her to my sponsor and every woman I knew, trying to help her. And I came back to Idaho, and I talked to her every day. And one day she called me drunk. It was right before Christmas. And she said, you know, I cannot do this. There is no way I can stay sober because I have too much guilt in my life. And I can't believe you would help me. You're the only person who's tried to help me, and I'm your husband's mistress. And I said, I don't care. I absolutely do not care. Please hang on 5 more minutes. I can have somebody at your house. I promise. I do not care. And I will tell you with every sincerity I have, I could have given a shit about my marriage when you're listening to someone who's dying of alcoholism on the other end of the line. She hung up that phone and she killed herself. And something broke for me. My life was never going to be the same again. And I can tell you in 2009, I left that marriage, and I'm so grateful for service because you've taught me no matter how I feel or what I'm thinking or feeling, get your ass out of bed and go do what you're supposed to do for Alcoholics Anonymous. And that kept me going. My sponsor carried me through that stuff. My sponsees, God bless them, carried me through that time. Because I was a mess. I was so angry and I was so hurt because this was not the way my life was supposed to work out. I don't know about the rest of you, but I had a script. And damn it, this was not my script. And I wanted to kill him. And I had at least the ability to move to the other side of the state so someone didn't end up with a steak knife through their left ventricle. And my sponsees wanted to kill him. And I said, please. You know, I'm angry. You can't afford it. You're his only chance. He needs to feel welcome in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. We can't afford enemy camps here. You cannot make him feel unwelcome in his own group. Hug him. Wave at him. Be nice to him. Please don't make him feel unwelcome. Now, I secretly hoped that he would contract some paratropical disease and his penis would fall off, but I never wanted him to drink. And the steps taught me how to work through that and how to write it out and say, guess what? Same flawed thinking I came in here with, that if I just manage well, I will have satisfaction in this life. If I dance fast enough, if I'm pretty enough, smart enough, make everything perfect, nothing bad will ever happen to Madeline. And I found that was absolute crap. I did not get a get-out-of-jail-free card. I still get wet when it rains. Anybody else get wet when it rains out here? Life still happens to me, even when I'm sober. But you know what? You taught me how to take principled actions. You taught me how to pray for him. You taught me how to be a kind and caring ex-wife, because I can't live in anger. Anger kills me. I had to find forgiveness, not for him, for myself, because I don't like feeling like that. You taught me what freedom feels like. I want freedom. And thank God that happened, because today I don't want to kill him. You know, I'm kind to him, and I'm gracious to him. And you know, sobriety gave me someone else in my life today. And he's a wonderful Southern man who knows how to hold the door and pull my hair. It's a perfect combination. So, you know, I want to talk a little bit about society. because I was this person who never felt like I fit in anywhere, and alcohol made me not care whether I fit in anywhere. And I came into AA, and I had that same thing, wanting to hide behind the pole. But you gave me a job. Make coffee. Stand at the door and greet people. Count this money. Do this, do that. You taught me how to be a part of. No greater gift in AA than to learn how to be a part of. Not have to be the in charge of everything, but to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I can tell you, a lot of times we talk about this in service, and it can become a really heady game. You know, people can shower you with a lot of love and attention. And I was honored to serve as the panel 52 delegate for Idaho Area 18. And they showered me with so much love and affection that you started to think they're going to play Hail to the Chief when I walked in the room. You start to look around like, who is this for? And it was really kind of, it was really uncomfortable. But I'm an alcoholic and I can get used to that shit. And in 2006, I was elected Pacific Region Trustee to the General Service Board. I know y'all all just went, no way. But I served on the board for 4 years. And it was an incredible experience of getting to meet people all over the place. But damn it, if people don't make a big damn deal about you when you show up. Now, my sponsees don't. They're usually standing behind me laughing because they know I'm no spiritual giant whatsoever. But, you know, it can become a little bit of a heady game in Alcoholics Anonymous when we're here for a little time, or we get a few positions, or we get some titles. And I don't know if you've ever had the thing. I worked the old-timers table on Wednesday. I've never seen so many pissed-off 40-something-year-olds in all my life. What? You raised it? I thought, well, maybe we should have a panel on humility for you. But anyway... But I want to close with this story because it's important to me that I remember why I'm here and what my purpose is in Alcoholics Anonymous. And to never, ever think that it's about me, but it's about us. Because it's the we in this program that makes it work. So I want you to picture Jesus, Palm Sunday, riding into Jerusalem on his donkey. The streets are packed. It looks like what we had out there last night. You can't walk through the crowds, and they're all waiting to see the Messiah, and they're waving palms, and they're throwing flowers, and they're singing, Hail to the Messiah, Hail to the Chosen One. I mean, it is the most incredible sight. Now, I want you to think for just 1 minute, what if the donkey thought all that was for him? And have I ever been guilty of that in Alcoholics Anonymous and in my service? I'm starting to think that it's all about me and becoming self-important and forgetting that it's this perfect program that I get to be a member of that is what it's about. So always remember when you leave here, you're just the jackass carrying the message just like me.
Okay. As I said before, my name is Mac, and I am an alcoholic. You know, when I first came in this program, I was a drunken SOB. And after I got sober, I was a sober SOB. And nothing changed. And I don't know why, but it seemed like I was in a hurry to get this program. And I remember my sponsor catching me one day. I guess I've been sober a few months. And he said, boy, what do you know about this AA program? And I stuck my chest out, told him how it works, chapter 5, looked up on the wall there and looked at them slogans and said, easy does it. But for the grace of God, think, think, think. And he looked at me and shook his head and said, no, that ain't it. He said, boy, go get your big book. I went and got my big book. He said, open it up to the first page. I opened up to the first page. He said, what do you see? I say, nothing. He said, that's where you at. You don't know nothing. Whoever told you, start reading a book at chapter 5. What does it say right there at the end of how it works? The description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after made clear 3 pertinent ideas. He said, where do you find that stuff? And then he sent me back to the beginning of the big book. And started getting an education. With that chapter, we are Gnostics. Bill's story, there is a solution. More about alcoholism. We are Gnostics. And then how it works. Thank God for sponsors. Because the stuff that was right in there was all that I needed to know before I stuck out my chest thinking I know something. See? But that is the reason why we cannot do this alone. This is a we program. See? And as a result of this man, he's dead now. God bless the dead. A little man named Robert Holmes. Little short man. Had a hump in his back, and he was younger than me, and he called me boy, and I didn't like it. But he knew how to stay sober, and I didn't. And that was the key, you know what I mean, see? And because of that man, I began to learn this program the way it was supposed to be, you know what I mean, see? I realized that, you know, that third step prayer was there for people like me. You know what I mean? Because when I came in the program, I didn't even know the Lord's Prayer. I had to go to the bookstore and get one of them copies of it so I could say the same words you were saying. You know what I mean? See? So that third step prayer, you know, started to mean something to me. You know what I mean? See? And something else. You know what I mean? See? God, I offer myself to thee. To build with me and to do with me as thy will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. Of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life, may I do thy will always. And I believe because of that I was on my way because I needed God's help. In that fourth step, you know, when they were talking about that international recognized list of major human failings, pride, greed, lust, anger, envy, gluttony, and sloth. Said it's not by accident that pride leads to possession, for pride leading to self-justification and always spurred on by conscious or unconscious fears. The basic breeder of most human difficulties. Pride lures us into making demands upon myself and upon others which cannot be met without perverting or misusing our God-given instincts. When the satisfaction of our instincts for sex, security, and society became the sole object in our lives, then pride stepped in to justify our excesses. It goes on and on. But I needed these lessons. I needed to know things that I didn't know when I came in here. I was at a meeting one Sunday morning and the speaker said, the alcoholic needs to pray. Don't you think it'd be better for you to pray, die and find out there ain't no God, than not to pray, die and find out that there is? Yeah. Struck a chord. And I went home and I hit my knees. I said, Lord, have mercy, I need you. Wasn't no flashes of light or anything like that, but it looked like from then on I was getting more out of my program. More things were coming together, you know what I mean, see? Because for a while there, the only prayers I was given was, God, help me. You know, when I didn't know what else to do. Foxhole prayers, you know what I mean, see? But because of this literature, you know what I mean, and then we are Gnostic, where it says deep down in every man, woman, and child, the fundamental idea of God, even though it may be obscured through prompt, through calamity, through worship of other things, but in some form or other, he's there. For faith with a power greater than ourselves, in the miraculous demonstration of that power in human lives, it's old as man himself. It's like the feeling that we have for a friend. Sometimes we have to search fearlessly, but he's there. He's much a fact as we were. You know, and I was beginning to understand some things that I didn't realize, you know what I mean, see? That I am a servant, you know what I mean, see? You know, and for so many years, you know what I mean, I was a taker. I was always looking for somebody to give me something. Gimme, gimme, gimme. My name could have been Jimmy. You know, see? But we learn, you know, about service. In this program, you know, because I learned about service, I got some joy of living that I didn't even know was possible. You know, it's really wonderful to try to help somebody else. They told me, you're looking down on somebody, make sure your hand is reached down to try to pull them up along with you. You know what I mean? That's what we do in this program. We reach out to others. That is the reason that the new people are the most important people in this room, because they are the ones that are keeping me sober. But I had to come here, and y'all taught me how to love, which I didn't know how to do. In fact, I didn't even know how to accept it. But because of what my sponsor did for me, carry me around, listen to my BS, and continue to care about me anyhow, that through his example I learned how to love my family and my sisters and brothers and all the people. Today, you know what I mean, I understand things that were really something I couldn't deal with. Because of that big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, some of them stories in there, especially that one, you know what I mean, see, that is next to the last story in the big book, you know what I mean, see, Freedom from Bondage. In that chapter, I learned a lot. In that last chapter, How to Handle Sobriety, I learned some more about me, see. But one of the things that was a puzzle for me for a long time was about what it says in the 12th step, you know what I mean, see. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And I was trying to figure out now exactly what principles am I supposed to practice. And finally, the 11th step came to mind. Love, forgiveness, harmony, truth, faith, hope, light, and joy. And we find that in that prayer, Lord, grant me, make me a channel of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me bring some love. Where there is wrong, the spirit of forgiveness. Where there is discord, harmony. And where there is error, truth. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. And where there is shadow, light. whether it's sadness, joy. Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to understand than to be understood, to love than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds, it's by forgiving that one is forgiven, it's by dying to self that one is born into a new life. Amen. I mean, you know. Yeah. And what is so great about these things is, you know, they even tell you how you're supposed to do it for a knucklehead like me. So you're supposed to read it slowly 2 or 3 times, savoring every word, trying to get the understanding and the meaning of it. You know, see. So I needed that big book. I needed those things along with, I even started reading my Bible again, too. You know, learning things that I never saw before, especially about forgiveness. Now I realize, you know, that if I don't forgive, I won't be forgiven. I haven't been a very nice person all my life. So I got to forgive everybody. You know, I hold nothing against no one. You know what I mean? See? And it's because of this wonderful program, you know what I mean? See? That picked me up, turned me around, put my feet on solid ground. You know, I wasn't quite sure the length of time that we had for this meeting. I tried to follow the directions as best as possible, and the directions said, you know what I mean, give each person 15, 20 minutes, you know what I mean? 3 people with 20 minutes takes up an hour, and the meeting's supposed to go for a half hour. I mean, an hour and a half, correction, you know what I mean? So that gave me a little more time than I thought for me to stand up here and run my mouth. You know what I mean? See? But then again, it's always a blessing, you know what I mean? Because it said, you know what I mean? Right at the end, of that vision for you, we realize we know only a little. Ask God in the morning what we can do for the alcoholic who still suffers. The answer will come, providing your own house is in order. But obviously you can't transmit something you haven't got. But I've got so much in this program, you know what I mean, see, that today I understand, you know what I mean, see, that without you there would be no me. I've learned that there are no big me's and little I's and none of that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? See, I've been sober a long time, and I realize what the program tells people that have been sober a long time. You know what I mean? See? Yeah. See? And I understand that it comes right in our literature. You know what I mean? See? You know, and because right after the promises, it says, continue to watch out for selfishness, dishonesty, resentments, and fears. When these crop up, we ask God to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. By this time, sanity will have returned. Now you recall the second step? Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity? We have did 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. We have been restored to sanity. The 10 of steps says is a spiritual axiom. Anytime I'm disturbed, there's something wrong with me. If I want to find out what's wrong with me, I go back to step 4. It holds the key, you know what I mean, see? Where have I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, inconsiderate. When I find it in step four, I tell somebody else about it, that's step five. I ask God's help, that's six and seven. And if I've harmed anyone, we have step nine. So it's a continuance of working these steps in my life on a daily basis that I'm able to stay right size. If we're able to stay right size, then we realize, that we can stay sober one day at a time. We have to remember certain things, because we're not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we have to carry the vision of God's will into all of our lives. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. This is the proper use of will. I think that we all know the promises. I think we can kind of share these together. If we are painstaking about this phase in our development, we'll be amazed before we are halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we'll see where our experiences can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We'll lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises?
Yeah.
No. They're being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. But they will always materialize if we work for them. Thank you. Thank you. You did a good meeting.